You're listening to the Illustration Hour podcast, an interview podcast where I talk to illustrators, art directors, and agents about the craft and business of illustration. My name is Julia Dufossé, and I'm an editorial and commercial illustrator based in Chicago. And I'm chatting with creatives within the world of illustration to learn about their process, the challenges they faced along the way, and how to succeed as an illustrator today. Welcome to the Illustration Hour. I'm your host and fellow illustrator, Julia Dufossé. I have a very special show planned for you this week, an interview with the illustrator Nolan Pelletier. But before I introduce Nolan, I'd like to apologize in advance for the suboptimal audio quality of this conversation. It's by no means unbearable, and I strongly encourage you to put up with it to hear what Nolan has to say. But yeah, that sort of stuff is part and parcel of podcasting, especially on a smaller budget. So speaking of budget, if you like the show and want me to keep interviewing creatives and illustrators, consider signing up for my newsletter Art Club at illustrationhour.com/newsletter. It's a weekly letter designed to help illustrators thrive, and it's totally free. One agent has told me she recommends the newsletter to all the illustrators she represents. So you can go sign up and check it out for yourself at illustrationhour.com/newsletter. And if you want to contribute directly to help the show, please consider signing up for a free 2-month trial of Skillshare Premium using the link in the description below. It's the best way I've found to help fund the show and give you access to amazing content without costing you any money. So on to the show, and my guest today is the illustrator and designer Nolan Pelletier. You can find Nolan on his website, which is nolannolannolan.com, or on Instagram, where he is at Nolan Phillips Pelletier. Nolan's deep love for collecting antiques, art, and printed ephemera influences his work very deeply. Over the years, he has developed a unique style and voice, combining his love of inky, blotty lines and textured colors. Nolan's deft deployment of the graphic and the ornamental, peppered with a healthy dose of humor, has attracted clients like the New York Times, The New Yorker, New Republic, New York Magazine, and many more. So I asked Nolan about his collection of ephemera and how his style and voice developed. I asked him how he got his first few jobs as an illustrator. And Nolan shares how he became friends with one of his illustration models, Nayad Einsel, and how she continues to influence his work today. We also delve into Nolan's personal project, the Somnolent Garden Rambler, a broadsheet paper inspired by Victorian newspapers that he lovingly writes, illustrates, and publishes every year. It was fascinating to hear more about the origin of this project, especially since I think this is one of the most effective and clever personal projects I've ever seen. It's just so good. You'll want to stick around until the end because Nolan also has some very good advice for those of you who are just starting out. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Nolan Pelletier. Nolan, hi.
Hi there.
Welcome to the show. I'm really happy to finally talk with you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I've been following your work for a really long time. I really like it. And I've been a big fan of your use of color and your use of line. I really like your work a lot. But yeah, so I'm really happy to have you on. And I'm going to have you start off by telling me how you describe what you do when you talk to people that are not within the creative community.
I usually just say illustrator. And then if they have any follow-up questions, I just answer them. I feel like most people who maybe to parents, friends, they always think I've gotten some people asking if I'm like an interior decorator, or they don't quite understand what a illustrator does. But Yeah, I usually just say illustrator.
And does most of your work come from editorial, or is it a bit of a mix?
It's a bit of a mix. I think last year I did a bit more sort of surface designy stuff, but I feel like, I've been doing more like package design and like pattern design along with the editorial stuff.
And is this something you studied at school, or did you sort of teach yourself?
The pattern design and surface design I taught myself. But I did go to school for illustration. I went to Ontario College of Art and Design up in Toronto.
And how was that? Was that useful to you? Or
I think it was great meeting a lot of the people who I went to school with. I met my wife Kaylee on the first day of school, and I think it was great sort of meeting that community of people. I don't know how much it's helped me professionally, but I do think just having that concentrated time where you're working, you're really dedicated to working on stuff was helpful. And I don't know if I would have had the patience to learn that all myself. So
yeah, is it kind of like in the States where you would do like 4 years? And it's usually a combination of studio classes and other classes here. How was the program kind of designed there?
Yeah, we did a lot of figure drawing and we had like the core classes for thesis, where we would work with the instructor to build our thesis and the sort of core illustration classes. But then we had a lot of, a lot of figure drawing and a lot of stuff that I don't really find applicable in my work. So if I could go back, I would take a lot of graphic design courses and sort of, the design side of it is really interesting to me, and I wish I could have learned a bit more of that in school.
So was it a program specifically geared towards you becoming an illustrator, or was
it was more of a...
Okay.
Yeah, I considered printmaking as well. I was really into printmaking.
So when you came into the program, you had a pretty clear idea that you wanted to become an illustrator, or not so much?
Yeah. By the time I entered the program, I had sort of decided on illustration. In high school, I collected a lot of old paper ephemera, like old brochures and booklets and antique magazines and newspapers and stuff like that. And I just always sort of liked the idea that this thing you drew would be reproduced so many times and sort of turned into trash and like turned into something ephemeral and just sort of float around in the world.
Mm-hmm. So you really had a love for that, the kind of like vintage, I guess not vintage, but historical artifacts, really?
Yeah, just print in general, I've always really responded to.
Was there a particular time period you were really interested in?
There's a big range. I always love the Victorian stuff, and then I also love all the mid-century stuff where they were sort of using those Victorian influences. But I think that's also definitely become more focused as the years have gone on. In high school, it was just sort of a mishmash of different stuff, whatever I could find at estate sales and tag sales and flea markets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was kind of like a hobby at the time.
Yeah. Definitely focused what I wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, at that young, it's kind of impressive to have such a focus, because a lot of times people get derailed at that age. But it's cool that you were doing that already. Were your parents kind of encouraging that? Or
Yeah. And when I was really little, I really wanted to be a Disney animator, which is sort of embarrassing.
That's cool. No, that's really funny.
Yeah. I had like the whole plan. I wanted to go to CalArts in California, where all the Disney animators go. And I found this binder in my house the other day that had like, it was like a 10-year plan for like becoming a Disney animator, and had all these like printouts I had printed off the web of like advice on how to be an animator. But I just don't think I'm a good enough drawer to be able to draw the same thing more than once. Like, I don't know how I'm so impressed by animators that they have that skill.
Were there some illustrators at Disney that you really admired at the time? I could see a few mid-century.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I don't think I was really aware of the sort of cooler, like, Mary Blair stuff or all the, yeah, the sort of more modern illustrators.
What's it, Ivan, I forget what his last name is. He's really cool. I love his backgrounds. I forget his last name, but I'll put him in the notes. There's a recent book about him, that's why I mention him, but just beautiful gouache kind of backgrounds.
Yeah, I'm always impressed with people who are good at gouache.
Yeah, it seems like at Disney at the time, they were mostly working in gouache.
Yeah.
It's so incredible that they would actually paint those backgrounds.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. What was in the binder? Do you remember what kind of plan were you making exactly?
Well, just like I'd read all the books on it and like all the like animation how-to books and like animation history books. And it was just, I found different interviews with animators and sort of, over researched what you're supposed to do if you wanted to be a Disney animator.
Yeah. It sounds like maybe you would have been disappointed to join Disney at like, now they work so differently. I feel like it evolved into something that maybe you wouldn't have wanted.
Yeah. And I just, it would be so hard just to draw the same thing over and over. I mean, I guess you could be a concept artist. That'd be a great.
Yeah.
And I see some beautiful like background art that different illustrators do now for different like Cartoon Network series and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just don't think I have the technical chops to do that. I think you need to really be able to churn it out.
It's probably something you learn over time too, but yeah. It's such a different career. Yeah. So after school, I'm not sure if you if they insisted on you building a portfolio during school. I imagine they did. But did you have one when you came out?
Yeah. Graham Romeu was my thesis instructor. He did, I don't know if you've seen that book, the Bigfoot book. That was
Okay.
It came out in like 2004 or 2005, I think. So he was my thesis instructor, and yeah, I had some stuff from school that I liked. Only a few pieces from my thesis ended up in my portfolio, and then a lot of it was sort of self-initiated stuff. But I was definitely going for something a lot simpler than I'm going for now. It was more Ben Shahn, at sort of trying to, a little bit more naive. And I think partially it was that yeah, I don't know if I would have been able to make more detailed work at the time. But yeah, it was a lot more simplified and a lot more, yeah, I would stick to like two or three colors and sort of, going for just a lot sparer look. So,
mm-hmm. Was it, were you making more like vector or not really? No.
No, I was doing it all in gouache and pen and ink, like a really like sloppy, like jagged pen and ink. And sort of, I would do the same line work that I do now, but just all hand done. And I feel like it before I had, before I was doing my work in Photoshop, I would still, combine everything in Photoshop and do all the layer separations.
Right.
But I wouldn't draw directly in Photoshop.
Oh, so now you draw directly in Photoshop. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty much all digital now.
Okay.
Once I sort of swallowed my pride and just started drawing 100% digitally.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, your work doesn't look digital. I mean, I think that's a good thing. Yeah. It really doesn't look, I mean, it's subtle and I think you don't see the digital as much as you could, but it's a tough thing to move from completely analog to digital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially for you, I feel like your line quality is so important.
Yeah. At some point, like maybe 5 years ago, I used to use a Sharpie for a lot of it, where I would use like bleedy sort of blotty paper and just sort of like stitch the line with the Sharpie, like stopping every couple of inches to give it that little blob. So I scanned that in, and then in Photoshop, I just moved the brush settings around until it matched the same spacing as when I would do it analog. And at first, I would just use that brush to make edits to my original drawings. But then I realized my life would be a lot easier and I could do more complex artwork if I just drew completely with that brush in Photoshop using a tablet. Gradually just went fully digital.
So it is like a custom made kind of brush that you made based on your... Yeah.
Yeah, and there's some available that are similar to it, but they just don't have the same spacing as I like.
Yeah, I mean, I guess most people don't realize, but it's not that hard to make a brush in Photoshop, especially if you base it off a piece of something you drew. You can do it.
Yeah, for a lot of the textures in my thing, in my artwork, I scanned in a bunch of old Charlie Brown soft cover books that I have from the 60s.
They have
like the worst... worst printing that's really nice looking, like
yeah
photography is really nice, like the in the centers of lines everything's all washed out and really like toothy paper texture, and then as it goes out to the outsides of the fill it'll be darker.
I always wonder how you get that kind of effect in your work. I thought it was watercolor textures maybe, but
I just use layer masks for the maybe that's too technical, but I use layer masks with the textures and then sort of do a vignette effect using masks so that it's denser as you get to the outside of a big fill, and on the inside it has a bit more texture.
Yeah, I've always really liked the texture you get in your work. It's, I don't know, it really reminds me of maybe watercolor, but it just looks... It does not look digital, which I really like. But yeah, so I mean, after school, so your portfolio was mostly, you said, naive. I don't know what you mean exactly by naive, but I imagine it's just like looking back at your old work, it's always hard.
Yeah. I think I just like embraced the mistakes a little more than I do now. Like I still try to like use a lot of inspiration from folk art and sort of naive art. But I think I'm a bit more anal about like the design of things now. And like when I was working traditionally, if something didn't come out exactly how I wanted, I'd be like, oh, it's good enough. And I feel like it was a bit of a learning process, sort of being like, oh, I can be really obsessive about this and just like work on it for hours until it looks how I want it to.
So what did you do after graduation, I guess? Did you sort of know what you wanted to do right away? Did you promote yourself and sort of reach out to art directors?
Yeah, I reached out to a lot of art directors. My thesis advisor, Graham, really encouraged me to go meet with all the people at the New York Times and set up an interview with some people there for me. Was very thankful for that. I probably would have eventually, but it was helpful having that sort of kick to do that. So I went to New York and I met with a bunch of people. And the first summer that I was out of school back in 2011, and my first job was with the New York Times travel section with Corinne Miller. And then I did some, that same summer, I did some stuff with the kids magazine Anorak. So those were my first jobs.
The French, it's a French magazine, right?
They're a British magazine.
Oh, okay, British, yeah.
Yeah, so I did some work with them too that summer. And then I had some odd jobs throughout the first couple of years. I definitely did a lot of promotion. I would send out usually 2 postcards a year for the first few years.
Uh-huh.
And then send out emails to different art directors whose work I admired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think meeting these art directors in person was helped or?
Yeah, like especially, I do think it did. Now I feel like I'm more hesitant too, because I, like when I was first out of school, I would meet these people and I had no clue who they were and like had never heard their names before. And like it was before on Instagram, I feel like a lot of people tag the art directors they work with.
Right.
But I feel like that was rarer on Tumblr. So yeah, I didn't really know much about anyone. But now there's these art directors whose work I've been seeing for like 5 years. And now I'm a little more intimidated to meet with people.
Yeah. In a way, it might be better to not know.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got your first few jobs. And I imagine after that, you kind of got more jobs as you became more established.
Yeah, I feel like it wasn't complete like straight trajectory. Like I always thought when I was starting out that like you would get a job for the New York Times and then it would be universally agreed upon that you were someone who gets jobs and everyone would give you jobs. And I didn't really realize that you need to keep getting jobs forever. I just sort of thought that you would be set for life once you like achieved your goal of getting into this publication. I didn't realize that then you have to keep every single month it's a struggle to get new ones.
Yeah. Well, in some respect, once you've gotten a few jobs with big clients like that, it does make your life easier in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they occurred with the regularity I thought they would initially.
Okay. Yeah.
I do think it is helpful just so that you have someone who to sort of vouch for you early on.
Mm-hmm.
So
for the first year out of school, were you struggling to make a full-time income on just illustration?
Yeah. Like I sort of, one of my teachers, a lot of them really were against having day jobs. They were sort of like, oh, you shouldn't ever have a day job. Like that will, stifle your creativity and like you won't have the like fire to go out there and get jobs.
Well, that's romantic. But
yeah. Yeah. So I think I felt really ashamed the first couple of years about having a day job, but I wish I wasn't so weird and hung up on not having one. I worked for I digitized the David Cronenberg archive for a while. The Canadian director did The Fly with Jeff Goldblum. I like digitized his archive one summer. And then just a bunch of other I was a food taster for a while.
Oh, that's cool. Your side jobs were not, they didn't seem like the worst.
Well, no, the food taster job was really horrible, but sort of wonderfully really? Horrible. There was this ad for it that was like, would you love to eat food for a living? And I was like, that sounds like it's probably bad, but I'm like, not sure like what way it would be bad. So I did that for like 9 months. And it was just the worst job. It was for this potato, the place that makes McDonald's French fries.
Okay.
And so all we would do is eat French fries all day. But
wait, this was a full-time occupation for
Netflix? No, it was like a three-day-a-week occupation. So
that's a lot. Like, what would you do?
Yeah, but we were like contract workers, so we were only there for like 5 hours for 3 days a week.
That's still a lot to me.
Yeah, sounds like a lot. Yeah, like it was a lot of responsibility for very little money. And then you would just be eating all these fries that were like fresh out of the oven with all this like oil in them and then spitting them out in cups. So your mouth would get all these like blisters from all the salt in the.
Ew.
And like everyone was having like health problems and like teeth problems because you're like chewing these foods and then spitting them out. And then like everyone was getting cavities and stuff.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
See, it sounded good at the beginning and then it just went.
Yeah. And after like, I worked there for like 6 or 8 months and wasn't really keeping track of how much money I was making. And at the end, I looked at my paycheck and it was like $3,000 for like the 8 months.
So it wasn't worth it. Did you get to meet Cronenberg or?
No, I never got to meet him. But that was I think that was my favorite part-time job because it was a scanner and every time you pressed a button, they would give you a dollar. Like the boss worked it out so that you got paid per item. So you would just have these big stacks of like David Cronenberg papers and you would just put the thing on the flatbed scanner and press a button. And then each time you did it, they would give you another dollar. So that was sort of a fun, weird dystopian job.
Yeah, they really gamified it.
So I'd come in at like 2 a.m. and just like scan in the fly script and press the button. And yeah, it was a good incentive to work. So.
Yes. So when did you kind of hit a point where you were able to not have a side job?
4 years ago. There were periods I kept in the early years, I kept doing sort of contract jobs like the Cronenberg one that would last 6 months. And then be off for like 8 months and then be like, oh no, I don't have any money, and then have to look for another contract job. But then like 4 or 5 years ago, I started doing illustration full time. But yeah, it's only been a few years that it really makes sense for me to be full time.
Yeah. And I imagine over those years of doing the side jobs and also developing your freelance practice, it was your style must have really evolved. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about how it's different today from the moment you graduated, but I imagine that it happened over a really long period of time, right?
Whenever I draw, I always like set different rules for myself, and I feel like the rules sort of evolve as you are working for a while. Like there's new restraints you put on yourself and new like techniques that you learn that you sort of when you start like with, especially with the detailed work that I have been doing the last few years, just the amount of time it would have taken me to do that, until I had a bit of practice with the different techniques I use, I feel like I just wouldn't have been able to make such complex work until I sort of was used to the process and used to different little tricks that you can do to speed it up.
So yeah, the detail part, I guess you're saying it really evolved with time.
Yeah, just sort of the longer I've been doing it, the easier it is to sort of tell where more detail should be, or just sort of how to balance the picture using detail.
Yeah, because it's hard to know exactly where to put it if it's going to overwhelm the entire illustration. Or in your case, the detail comes in the form of all these lines and kind of almost engraving effect that you have. But where did that come from? Did that come around the time where you were like working more, or?
Oh, I did. Yeah. So there was this. I always used a lot of line. Yeah, I always used the. I really love the cross hatching and the sort of shading from like the late 50s, early 60s, when that was really popular, that style. Yeah, there was this illustrator. Maybe if we're talking about influence, this would be more applicable to that discussion. But when I was in college, I would always look through the old Graphis annuals, the old design magazine. I would look through the old back issues of that, and also print magazine and a few of the other annuals. And I kept seeing the name Walter and Nyad Einzel. I would see that name over and over again.
Oh, yeah, the couple, the Einzels.
Yeah, so I'd see them over and over again. And I just, every time I'd see a piece I liked, I would say, I love that. And then I would go check who the name was, and it would say the Einzels. And then I found out that she was still alive, Nyad Einzel, and she was living maybe an hour away from where I grew up. So I wrote her a letter and I reached out to her, and I sort of was like, oh, I am from Connecticut. Like, I would really love to meet you one day. So then in maybe 2009, maybe, I visited her house in Connecticut and struck up a friendship with her. And then, yeah, it was sort of amazing. Her illustrations are a huge influence on my work and have all the really intense detail in them. And going to her house, her entire house was just, we collected a lot of the same things. She collected old like advertising tins and all this old folk art, and had this like amazing book collection. And she just, yeah, we had a lot of the same shared interests. And then she just had thousands and thousands of pieces of her artwork. And her husband, who was also an illustrator and worked in the same vein, he would make these life-size automatons that were all carved out of wood and looked just like their illustrations, but were like real things that would be life-size with clockwork inside them. So you would like shake one of their hands and the head would like fall off, and then an arm would move up and the head would slide down the arm. just like all these crazy complex robots that he made
back
in the
60s. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's just like the best possible scenario for when you see something you like and it's like, oh, there's like a theme park for this like illustration style you like. And like, yeah, so just having that friendship with Nyad, I stayed in touch with her until her death in 2016, I think she.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I stayed in touch with her, and then just seeing her artwork and how complex it was, that really taught me a lot about the different ways to balance detail and work, and just the other illustrators that from that era who would do that. And so after her death, I purchased a large portion of her work and a lot of her inspiration folders.
Oh, okay. Were they at a kind of like an auction or something?
Yeah, there was an estate sale after. And so I purchased a lot of that. And then, yeah, and I do think it's been really helpful having all of that reference material. I also purchased all of her, all of the vintage graphic design magazines from that era that I would always read back in college. And just like this huge amount of material. And I think having that has, in the last like 4 years, has been a big help when, and just being surrounded by the artwork from her. And then I also collect other illustrators from that era, like Pushpin Studio sort of stuff. I collect the illustration originals. So they're all around the house. And then just like, even just like seeing them every day, you like notice little details that they do, like different illustrators have different signatures, and just sort of seeing the way they balance everything and seeing the way that they, just sort of design with pattern has been really influential.
Yeah, I had no idea you actually were friends with Nyad. They were a huge deal, both her and her husband. But and so did she ever give you feedback on your work or look at your work?
Yeah, I'd show her all my work, and she would... each time I would come, she would say, oh, what have you done? Like, what new work have you done? And I would show her. And yeah, she wouldn't offer like too much like feedback. She would just sort of be appreciative and encouraging.
Well, she sounds lovely.
It was a really nice friendship. And at a certain point, I feel like it transitioned a bit to, at first, I always wanted to talk about like the past and her career. But at a certain point, it sort of morphed into just wanting to spend time with her and just like be with her in the present.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of amazing. It always felt to me like we had so many shared interests outside of even illustration, which was sort of amazing. I have this crate that's been in every apartment I've lived in, this old biscuit, this like Victorian biscuit shipping crate. And she had the same one in her living room. And I was like, oh, that's in my apartment. And then just like little things like that. But so it sort of felt like, and she liked all the other illustrators that I was so passionate about. She, like almost every single one of them, she was also a fan of. So like in her inspiration folders that I purchased after her death, there's like a Pushpin Studios folder that's just like hundreds of clippings of every Pushpin thing she ever saw, and like Ben Shawn and like all the illustrators that I love. She just like was collecting them for all those years. So yeah, it's just been a great resource and sort of a treasure trove.
That's really cool. I really like this idea of physical inspiration folders.
Yeah. I'd sometimes try to do that with illustrators I love, with like newer ones. Like when I see their work, I'll like cut it out of the magazine or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't last very long. I'm not organized enough.
Yeah. Did she also put in notes about what she liked?
No,
or not
she
really?
Didn't. And no? Okay. I didn't. Yeah, there were a bunch of people that I always wondered whether she knew while she was, when I would talk to her. And she would sort of go, oh, yes, I remember their work. But she would never, like, have detailed recollections about them. But then after she passed, going through some of her books on her bookshelf and, like, through the inspiration folders, I found out that she knew a bunch of the illustrators who I love. Like, have you seen Joseph Lowe's work?
No, I haven't.
Joseph Lowe is my other favorite illustrator. He's this illustrator from the 50s who would do these sort of medieval and folk art inspired, very loose pen and inks. And I found out that she knew him, and that they, I found some letters between the two of them with the illustrations he did for her inside of them.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So just, it's, yeah, I just like that connection to all the illustrators I love that, one degree away from it with knowing her, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever thought about, I guess, publishing these things for, I guess, in for others or?
Yeah. Yeah. Not just her work. I also would love to collect Joseph Lowe's work because he has a really amazing, he was just so prolific. And he's never had a monograph of his work, like with Pushpin and all those guys. They're so well represented in all the design books. Mm-hmm. But with Joseph Lowe and the Einzels, I feel like they're really underappreciated. And
yeah, the Einzels, they don't have a book about Einzels,
do they? Yeah, I'm hoping. I know that her family was thinking of trying to organize something. So I'd love to see if they ever come up with something.
Yeah, yeah. But I meant more for the inspiration folders, which you're the only one who has them, right?
Yeah. And it's not it's like a single, like a banker's box full of them.
Yeah. But I know they did that for Edward Bawden's like scrapbooks. There's a wonderful little book about all his scrapbooks. And yeah, I was thinking something similar can be kind of cool with all those clippings, even letters. In the Bawden book that I'm mentioning, there's a lot of letters between him and other illustrators with little illustrations to that they exchanged, and it's just really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, the Parsons has the majority of the Einzels archive of their letters and stuff like that. It's just like a very small section of it that I have. And then I have a lot of their original artwork, but there's apparently something like 25 archive boxes full of their work at Parsons that I'd like to finish. I've gone through a couple of the boxes when I've been visiting New York, but I'd love to dig deeper. Yeah, because when you would visit NIAID, you wouldn't really, like, we would spend, like, afternoons, I'd be like, oh, can we look through a box of your work? And we would just, like, go through one by one and sort of hear the stories about them. But I didn't want to sort of overwhelm her every time I went by being like, now we're going through your filing cabinet together, you know?
No, yeah, that's interesting. And she also did she collaborate? Like, they had such a intense kind of collaboration, her and her husband, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting because their styles are so similar. I can only just now sort of tell them apart now that I'm really, so familiar with them. But I couldn't for years. And she said that on some projects they would collaborate. But also other times when I'd ask her if Walter worked on something, she would sort of say, oh no, like we only did that occasionally. But I think if they had like a tight deadline, one of them could sort of like fill in pattern and detail and stuff like that.
That's really interesting. And I've always like kind of wondered how they work together. That would be interesting to know more about too. But yeah. So anyway, this was like a little detour, but I had no idea. And I really admire their work as well. So you collect a lot of art, you said, but where do you usually find these?
Yeah. Like they come mainly, I have like a ton of eBay alerts and different like auction houses. And I'm always sort of checking like weird auction websites, and it's interesting because a lot of the stuff I really love is not very expensive to collect. Like I have a bunch of John Alcorn artwork.
They're not expensive.
Well, they're really hard to like. They don't come up very often, and they're hard to find. But then when they do come up, they're not all that well known. So it can be, most of it is under $100 for a lot of the artwork.
Yeah, that's really undervalued. Yeah.
I got a Milton Glaser. I purchased a illustration of his from Austria last summer that I bought. I got like 4 Seymour Quast pictures and 1 Milton Glaser watercolor, and with shipping it came to like $100.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. They lost my Seymour Quast picture. I originally got like 8 Seymour Quast pictures, and then they lost one of them. And then they were like, oh, would you like this giant Milton Glaser watercolor instead? and I was like, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know that. I always assumed it would be more expensive to like buy out those things. But I want to ask you more about your work and how you sort of how you approach an assignment. So I was wondering if we could maybe take one of your illustrations as an example, and you could work us through how you kind of approach it. I guess what you do when you get the assignment, and then also like how do you work more concretely?
Yeah, so did we want to talk about a specific assignment?
No, I think we were talking a little bit about that before the show. You mentioned that one that would be kind of nice to do would be, was it?
Yeah, the New York Times April Fools.
Yeah. Let's do that one. Yeah.
So that one was sort of inspired. I had sent out the newspaper that I published, the Somnolent Garden Rambler, a couple of months prior. And then the art director, Andrew Sondern, reached out because for April Fools, they were doing a selection of pieces that were sort of curious and interesting stories from the historical stories from the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
And so that one was fun because it was red, and I got to do a few little header illustrations and body illustrations as well. But I usually start very loose with my illustrations, like my roughs are embarrassing to look at.
Do you do them by hand or?
I usually do it on the computer, but with like a big fat chunky brush instead of a little tiny pencil like I usually do. So I'll just do something very loose and sort of getting not even the basic shapes in, just sort of closest to stick figures as I can without being completely ashamed. So I'll do that and sort of try to get the initial composition down and just a general feel for it. I feel like I used to always try to do really smart concepts, but lately I've been just doing whatever stupid thing I want to do and liking it better. Like I used to think everything needed like 2 layers of meaning. But now I just, if it's like an article about like dogs, I'll just draw a nice picture of a dog instead of like,
trying to come up with some kind of intelligent way to express 2 things. Yeah.
Yeah, like an allegorical image with like.
Yeah, I'm definitely guilty of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's can look a little overworked sometimes, but I think the confidence to kind of pare it back also comes with experience, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. And I'm always happy when I do. I used to submit ideas that I wouldn't want to draw.
And oh, okay, yeah.
So now I try to really only submit things I would actually want to draw.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. So I'm always happy when someone is like, Sater, and he's playing a pan flute and like is on a laptop. Like, yeah, that's perfect. Like, it's always nice when they go for stupid ones. But yeah, so I don't forget where I was with that.
Oh, no, we were talking about the roughs and the concepts. And so I guess once a sketch has been selected, you do all of your work in Photoshop. Is that right?
Yeah. So sometimes I'll scan in additional textures for an image, but I have most of my textures in sort of big folders. Once they're approved, I'll sort of decide on a level of detail depending on how large the picture is and how, sort of how complicated the illustration is.
Mm-hmm.
And then just sort of go in and start building. Just start like building the detail throughout the whole thing, like focusing on little portions at a time, and sort of crossing my fingers so that it will all come together at the end.
Yeah. I want to talk more about your side project, which or personal project, maybe not side, but the Somnolent Garden Rambler, which is a paper that you kind of made up and illustrate everything. Can you describe what it is? I mean, I'm not doing it justice by...
Yeah, a broadsheet newspaper, so like an oversized newspaper that I write and print and distribute and draw. But I feel like that sounds like in like elementary school where you're like, my great book by Nolan, drawings by Nolan.
Well, there's nothing primary school-y about it. It looks very polished. It looks like a pastiche of a 19th century kind of newspaper. It's really cool. It's very detailed, and you seem to do all the type work also, or you embellish like these headlines, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah. The first issue and the title of it were inspired by old 19th century type catalogs, because they'll have all this like nonsense text in them where it will loquacious interlocutors like midnight tunnels and all these like sort of nonsense words that are strung together. And one of them was the Somnolent Garden, and then that I liked that, but it didn't sound like a newspaper. And the other one was the Garden Rambler. as their one of the suggestions for a newspaper title that they had in their like newspaper typeface section. So I mashed those two together. And then a lot of the headlines that I would use were directly taken from the old type catalogs, collaged together, and they would sort of inspire the illustrations.
So how many of these have you done so far?
I've done three. Yeah, and each have a slightly different format. The first one was black and white, and then the second one was longer and like a tabloid format with a spot color cover. And then the third one that I just came out with is purple and orange throughout.
And you don't sell these, right?
Yeah, I don't send out any other promos anymore. I just send out newspaper once a year.
I mean, I imagine it's an incredibly effective way to promote yourself, actually, because it's really cool and it's not just another mail or, you know, another postcard or...
Yeah, I've been happy with the response just because, I do feel like it's a physically big object, and I feel like something in everyone's brain is fairly literal in the sense that if you see something big, you're like, oh, I can hire you to do something bigger. Whereas when I was sending out these little postcards, they're like, oh, here's like a spot illustration.
So that's interesting. Yeah, I've never thought of that, but that's interesting. Yeah, so don't send your illustrations on a Matchbox.
Well, that'd be really cool too, though. Yeah, it was always bumming me out when I would do personal illustrations and then they would just be sort of trapped on Instagram without any like real world printed component to them. So it's nice sort of collecting them all together and sort of giving them this like little world to live in.
Yeah, and because it is really a world, because it's a very, I mean, it's also a storytelling kind of exercise. But how do you actually print it? I mean,
I just use a local newspaper printer, who are sort of terrible. I always have problems with them. But they are cheaper than any other newspaper printer. And so you can just print out a huge number. I get like 3,000 of them. Each time I do it for not all that much money. Yeah, so I'm spending the same amount I was on printing out postcards.
Really?
Able to get this like giant thing.
Yeah, because it's, I guess you want the quality of the printing to be pretty almost low because you want it to emulate a newspaper. Yeah.
Yeah, and I still put different textures and sort of shadows that make it look like it's even worse printing. So I always feel bad for printers when I make them do bad looking print jobs on my artwork.
Yeah. And so how, I know there's a lot of type in this particular project, and it's kind of amazing. I was wondering if you do you make up all this type yourself? Do you use like old reference, like Letraset or something like that?
Yeah, I have like a lot of it is scans from like Rob Roy Kelly's Wood Type. Have you seen that book before?
Yeah, and actually, there's I've shared this in a newsletter that I have. I've shared there's a version that's available that somebody just photographed online on Flickr, actually. So yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So some is scans from that I just sort of collaged together the headlines.
Uh-huh.
And then other ones I have just different reference books from the 60s and 70s that have a lot of the Victorian Revival fonts in them. So I have scans of those. Or I'll go to the reference library and make scans of some of their old lettering books and then just sort of collage those together.
Do you ever make your own custom type?
Yeah, I did some of the headlines. I did, I don't know how to say it nicely. How do you say lettres hombres? Monstres. I can't say it out loud. I've only...
You've only thought it, yeah.
Yeah, I did a version of that because every version of it that I've ever seen is just the like worst quality.
Uh-huh.
No definition to the lines, so I sort of redrew that, slightly condensed it and redrew all of it with lots of detail in it. So I've been using that one a lot in my work lately, using it for headlines or as sort of a header font for things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then there are also a lot of good, I do use a lot of digital type as well when I'm feeling lazy.
Uh-huh.
But it's sort of tricky to find a lot of the Victorian ones that aren't really terrible quality reproductions of them.
Yeah.
They're all sort of made for desktop publishing and aren't kerned correctly, so.
Have you ever used some of those Dover like visual libraries? They have a lot of old, they collect a lot of old types. I imagine for you, you probably have those primary source materials, not this, because this is more of a secondary source. But
no, I have a lot of the sort of Dover stuff because just it would be so expensive for a lot of the books.
Uh-huh.
For the original source material.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're wonderful. I always love that sort of clip art stuff.
I love it too. I think it's, yeah, they're really cool. And they're actually usually pretty cheap because no one really cares about them except for...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's always surprising to me how little of that sort of stuff has been digitized.
Uh-huh.
Not the Dover books themselves, but just like the material they came from. I'm always surprised more of it isn't available online.
I recently I found out about this website called The Peculiar Manicule. I don't know if you know about
it. Yeah, I really love them.
Yeah, it's a wonderful little collection that I guess a designer put together of... He had this collection of old 60s, 70s stuff that he just had. And it's really cool. I wish there was more of that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very impressive. I want to reach out to him because I've never seen... I thought I had a big collection of that sort of stuff, and then he's uncovered a lot of stuff I had never seen before.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about putting your collection out there in that kind of way or another way? And
I used to love... I had a Flickr in high school where I'd post a lot of the ephemera I collected. And I loved Flickr before it got taken over by Yahoo.
I mean, it still works.
Yeah, but it is very buggy and
yeah.
It's not very active, the communities.
It's not, no.
I miss all the communities for like a lot of great illustrations were posted on there at a certain point in time. There mm-hmm. were a ton of great illustration communities. And yeah, so I sort of miss those. Because now you see it on Instagram and you just get everything's cropped all tiny mm-hmm. and ugly.
It's just not the same, yeah. I really like Flickr. I still have some Flickr pages that are saved up that are just old stuff that was posted a while ago. But it, yeah, there's some really cool little things in there. It's really hard to actually find that stuff. If you look inside Flickr, you kind of have to get... it's really buggy. I was wondering, how long does it usually take you to kind of finish an edition of the Garden Rambler?
I'll sort of... It depends, because I'll use a lot of artwork. I'll sort of take both editorial jobs I've completed and personal work I've completed and incorporate it into it. But even with doing that, it still usually takes like a month where every moment of my downtime is frantically making the newspaper. Because I also collect all of the, I write or collect all of the text in it. Because that's sort of, it's mainly decorative, the text. But if you read it, they're actual stories and old news articles and new news articles that I write.
Yeah, the body copy for the
Yeah. I sort of, I take old sources. I'll take like old newspaper articles or like books on just like interesting things that I found. And then I'll sort of, take like a sentence from here and a sentence from there and sort of mash them together until they make a new story that has a bit more of a cohesive feel to it.
Just sort of
playing with that sort of collaging of text is sort of fun for me. So
And it gives it this kind of absurd surreal feeling when you read it. It's quite funny. Some of the headlines are really funny.
Do you have a copy of one of them?
No, I've looked at the one that's on your website, but even that is super cool. I was going to ask you, when you started doing this, was it for a particular reason? You mentioned like that the size itself you thought would inspire people to hire you for bigger jobs. But I imagine, I don't know, for something that takes such a long time to make and that feels so personal, there was more than just the promotional aspect to it.
I just love print in general. Like, I love the feel of print and the look of print, and just feeling a little I wanted something. It's also, since it's a free newspaper, I sort of like the idea that you're connecting with people in a way that's not, I love social media and Instagram and all that too, but it's nice sort of having, I want it to be something that you'd sort of find, like, I leave them sometimes like at coffee shops and also sometimes just like at laundromats and like places like that. Really? Cause it's just sort of, I want it to be something that if you found it somewhere, you would, be, or at least if I found it somewhere, I would, be interested and sort of want to know where it came from. Not that I want jobs from those people who are finding it or anything, but just, I want it to be something that existed in the physical world.
Do you get messages from people sometimes?
And that's really great. Where it's like, I found it at my barber. And I'm like, oh, how did it end up at a barber? And they're like, what is this? And I'm like, oh, it's my newspaper.
Have people tried to buy it from you? Or?
Yeah, and I feel bad. I'm sorry to anyone who has tried to buy it and I haven't responded to your comment or message. It's sort of difficult to ship because it will cost more to ship than I think the newspaper is really worth. If I send it from Canada, it's like $7 or $8 just to send one issue of it.
It is steep, yeah.
Yeah, and then I'm not getting, then it also takes a lot of time packing them and bringing them to the post office. So I don't know if it, I'd like to find out a better way of how to distribute them to people who want them. And occasionally I'll list them up in a shop, or if someone sends me an email, I'll send it out to them.
Yeah, I think it's just a really fantastic idea, and I love the look of them. It looks amazing. Yeah, and I mean, putting color in there must be hard and costly too.
Yeah, and it's not too bad because they do, like, the place where I print it, they print all the local community papers, so they're fairly low cost. One, the black and white one, was only like $500 for 500 Canadian, so that's even less in the U.S.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, but it's still not the cheapest thing to do, I mean.
Yeah, and then the color ones are slightly more expensive.
But, yeah. Do you have plans to keep doing that?
Yeah, I'd like to if time allows. Yeah, it was a bit. As things have gotten a little busier in the last few years, it's been a little tricky to.
I'm sure. Yeah. So I know we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you one more question. And that is just, if you could speak to young illustrators or illustrators who are starting out, not necessarily young, I don't want to make an age determination, but if you could speak to illustrators who are starting out and you could give them advice, so what would you say?
I do think it's important to not be afraid of rejection and also to not consider people not paying attention to your rejection. Because I feel like early on, I would send out a lot of stuff and not really hear anything back from people. And still now that happens. Like if I send out a bunch of my newspapers to people, I'll hear from like 1% of people. But I don't necessarily consider, not taking that as a rejection and just keep on being persistent with that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think is important. There was this old clip art book I had that said, "Good news, keep shaking the tree." And I've Googled that and tried to find if that's like a phrase people use, but it's not. It's just like a dumb thing in the clip art book. But I sort of like that idea of like illustration being like shaking the tree and like making more artwork and like hoping fruit will fall down.
It's true that in the very beginning, especially when you don't hear anything back, it's hard not to take it as a rejection or a judgment on your work.
But I don't think like disinterest is really a rejection or even mm-hmm. A reflection of anyone's worth.
Would you encourage people who are starting out to start reaching out sooner rather than later, or do you think there's a time you have to wait to?
I definitely reached out right away. Mm-hmm. It also was a slow process for me, so I don't know if that's, I feel like it, as long as your work has like a base level of professionalism, you do work that looks professional, I guess that's a hard thing to quantify.
It is, yes.
But yeah, I think you should reach out sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. So I want to ask you a few little kind of sillier little questions before we end this. So one of my first questions is actually one of my favorites because I like to get book recommendations from people. But I was wondering if you could give us if there are books that you continually return to for inspiration or guidance and if you could share a few of those with us.
Yeah. I think like we were talking about earlier, Rob Roy Kelly, Wood Type is really great.
Yeah.
One I like that's a used book, but is still pretty easy to find is Graphis Ephemera, I think it's called. And it's all a bunch of ephemera from different artists that was mainly either self-promotion or like printed matter that they would send out.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really great book. And I'm trying to think of ones that are easy to find and really good. Oh, I got the Codex Seraphianus recently
My
wife. So I don't know if I can recommend that since I bought it for her and not me. But that's a great book.
Yeah. I wanted to get that one yet too.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap right now. It's like $75, but it's just this enormous book that you could read for days.
Yeah. Do you prefer to get your inspiration in a printed physical form?
I definitely love a good book. But I think part of it is just that a lot of the stuff that I like hasn't been put online yet. So if it were online, I would probably consume it that way too. I also love Instagram and looking at all the current illustrators' work.
Yeah. I mean, since you mentioned a lot of your inspirations are from like mid-century, I imagine also you could go back even further to those who were their inspirations, like more even medieval or...
I do think what's great about the old magazines from the 50s and when I was sort of developing my interests in school is that they would have all the like modernist artists, the sort of modern in quotes graphic design. And then right next to it, they would have all the inspirations for that. So it'd be the old woodcuts in the old medieval art. And there was one article, the cave paintings of snake charmers in Tanzania, and like all these just like esoteric sources that all these people who I was inspired by, that they, you know, that they were all reading these same articles and the same books and sort of looking back at that stuff. So I feel like it really did shape my interests in the early art, like folk art, and a lot of like I love old gravestones and like colonial art and fractures and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
or fractor. So yeah, I think it's fun looking at a wide range.
What's your favorite thing about your job?
I do like staying at home. That's really nice.
Yes.
And just, it is fun just that the stuff you make has, like, I feel like it's a very democratic sort of art form, that it just is sort of
mm-hmm.
bobbing around and being thrown away or being kept by one or two people. It just that it's out there in the world is sort of a fun concept. The whole mass production aspect of it is sort of fun.
Uh-huh. What's your least favorite thing about being a freelance illustrator?
Maybe self-doubt. I don't know.
Yeah, that can be rough, yeah.
Yeah, just the stage in every drawing you do where you're like, it's horrible, and then you're like, oh, it's the best drawing, and then you're like, no, it's not, it's really bad.
I think sometimes there's a moment where I doubt that I will be able to finish it and it will look good sometimes, and it's silly, but it's like, suddenly you don't believe in yourself at all.
But then when you get to the moment where you do make it look like you wanted, that's always a nice feeling.
It is a nice feeling. And then I tell myself I should never doubt it myself. But then it happens again the next time.
Yeah, but sometimes it takes a while for it to, like, yesterday I was working on something and I just felt like it looked horrible until like the last like final tweak of it. And then I was like, yep, changing that like one spot to white on the donkey, that really did it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I know I didn't ask you about this before, but you said you only used to use very minimal colors, like maybe one or two, but how did you sort of become better at using color? And I guess you use a lot of color now.
Yeah, I think, like, I always loved the two-color printing process that you see in a lot of mid-century books. And so I always enjoyed that. But then maybe just, I feel like looking, as I started looking at more of the late 60s, early 70s stuff, where they were using like fluorescent spot colors and really doing interesting things with the way that they were combining the colors and different shades. I think that sort of inspired me to get a lot more colorful.
Yeah, you use a lot of these kind of very bold, almost neon colors sometimes, but they have to be used kind of sparingly, I feel. Or not, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I've had some art directors who are, I'll submit a final and they'll be like, okay, now desaturate it completely. So gray and muddy.
Yeah.
I sort of begrudgingly.
That's interesting because I thought I had seen a general trend towards more neon kind of
mm-hmm.
bright colors. Maybe just there's been a revival of that kind of like 70s psychedelic thing lately, or maybe it's just me. I'm just feeling like there is, but there isn't. But yeah, I kind of figured everyone was really into those kinds of colors right now. But anyway, so I don't want to take up more of your time. But thank you so much for coming on and talking with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. That was fun.
And that was my conversation with Nolan Pelletier. I hope you enjoyed it. Nolan, thank you so much for sharing all these beautiful stories and for sending me copies of The Somnolent Garden Rambler. If you're curious about any of the things we talked about, book references, projects, or people, check out this episode's show notes at illustrationhour.com/Pelletier. And if you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing to my weekly newsletter, Art Club. It's made especially to help creatives thrive, and it's my way of sharing resources, inspiration, tools, and more directly with you. It's also the best way to ask me a question or interact with me. You can just hit reply on any of the newsletter's issues and I'll get back to you. You can find out more on illustrationhour.com/newsletter. So yeah, that's it for this week. I hope you have a very creative week.